Well, again, welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. In this part of the show, we'll be talking about white-collar crime. Today in Houston, Jeff Skilling, the former Enron chief executive, is expected in federal court to be sentenced for his part in the collapse of his company. Most people who are keeping an eye on this think that he could receive a sentence of at least 25 years. At more than that, it would be the longest sentence ever handed down for a white-collar criminal. And that, of course, will put the whole Enron story back in the news once again. In recent years, there have been a number of cases, very big cases involving large companies and large amounts of money. And it might make you wonder, is somehow white-collar crime becoming a more serious problem than it has in the past? And then to go to that, to the very question of why it is that people do this. And is this like other kinds of crime, or is it different from other kinds of crime? And those are some of the questions that we'll consider here this morning in this part of the show as we talk with Neil Shover. He is a professor of sociology at the University of Tennessee at Knoxville. And has done writing and research on this subject. He is the co-author of a recent book, actually I think it's been out for about a year now, titled Choosing White Collar Crime. It's published by the Cambridge University Press and looks at this very question, is white collar crime the same as other kinds of crime and why it is that people do it? Questions here as we talk are certainly welcome. 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. It's not the number to call to make a pledge. We hope that you will, but if you want to call in here on the show, it's completely separate. Pledging is not required. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Shover, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us. We certainly
appreciate it.
Maybe to begin, I'd like to have you talk a little bit about how it is that criminologists, people like you, have studied crime, how they have thought about why people commit crime. And let's sort of set white-collar crime aside for a second, because it hasn't been studied perhaps quite as much as street crime. What has been the main way of thinking about why it is people commit crime?
Well, the fashionable answer to that question changes from time to time. But for the past three decades or so, policymakers in the U.S. and in other Western nations have been guided by the assumption that people choose to commit crime, and that they choose to commit crime following some sort of weighing or some assessment of the likely gains and losses of doing so. And this is an explanation which has been used widely to justify what's been done in the name of street crime control. We've built new prisons. We've lengthened prison sentences. We've made many changes in the way we respond to street crime, most of them justified by the notion that criminals choose, and if we make their lives unpleasant enough when they get caught, they won't choose to do that again. Now, in the area of white-collar crime, we assume that the same explanation applies. We assume that there's one explanation that can be fashioned that would explain variation in all kinds of crime. It's just that we have not talked as much about white-collar crime as choice as we have in the past three decades about street crime as choice.
Just to talk about white-collar crime for a moment, the kind of attention that very high-profile cases like Enron and WorldCom and others, the kind of attention that's received over the last however many years, you know, 3, 4, 5 years, might make one think that somehow there's more white-collar crime going on in now that, you know, say in the past decade, 10, 15 years, there's been more white-collar crime than in the past. Is that the case, or is it the case that because we have seen some situations where the companies were very big and the amounts of money that we're talking about are very big, and so it's gotten a great deal of media attention?
Well, it has gotten a great deal of media attention, and there is always the risk that it gives a distorted picture of what has happened and the face of white-collar crime. But there is good reason to believe that white-collar crime has increased and probably has increased substantially. Unfortunately, we do not measure white-collar crime with any degree of sophistication at all. And consequently, we can't measure with any degree of precision changes in white-collar crime from one year to the next or from one decade to the next. But if you start with the assumption that all of the variables, all of the social conditions and economic conditions that are thought to explain variation in white-collar crime, all of those point in the direction of the belief that, yes, it has increased substantially. And so what we do in the book, Choosing White-Collar Crime, is we examine changes in these conditions which there is reason theoretically to believe will have led to a change, an increase in white-collar crime.
Mm-hmm. Why is it that you think that people who study crime have not given more attention to white-collar crime?
It's always been a bit of a back burner issue for most academics who study crime and criminology, and I suppose one of the reasons, I'm only speculating, but one of the reasons is that there's a good deal of controversy that surrounds even the meaning of the concept or the notion of white-collar crime. And so if one spends time doing work in this area, it can be frustrating that there's so much dissensus and disagreement, but that may or may not be a part of the reason.
Hmm. Well, let us go and jump into the subject of why it is that people commit crimes, and it has to be that there's something attractive about it, that they think that they're going to get something. There is some gain here with white collar crime. I suppose here we're talking about money, and I suppose ultimately with a lot of crimes, that's what we're talking about, is essentially it's money.
Well, all of crime is explained fundamentally by just a handful of conditions or emotions, greed, lust, and power, and they just take different shape and they're refined in different ways in different places. But money certainly is one of the principal motivators that causes people to choose to commit crime, but advancement in the corporate world or a reputation as being someone who's just a little quicker and a little brighter than the rest, these are also reasons that people might choose to commit crime.
Hmm.
Jeffrey Skilling is an example of a person who apparently took great pride and arrogance, I suppose, in his reputation for being exceptionally bright person.
Yeah. Well, that was what they said about him, and what a lot of people in Enron is that the thing always was that they thought they were the smartest guys in the room.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. That's the title of the book.
Yes, indeed. In fact, yeah, someone took that and took it as the title of one of the books about Enron, smartest guys in the room. So that somehow, and I suppose that may well be true of some of other people who commit other kinds of crimes, and that is that part of the lure is not so much the actual material gain, but part of the lure is demonstrating, if only to yourself, that in fact you are smarter than everybody else. That is, you can do it, you can break the rules, and you can get away with it. So that's sense, in a sense, it's a way of being able to say to yourself, the rules apply to everybody but me.
Yes, I mean, that's got to be a motivation for some white collar crime.
Mm. We have a caller here to bring into the conversation, and we'll do that at this point. The caller is in Champaign County on a cell phone, I believe, or in Champaign on a cell phone, and it's line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Caller there, line number one. Yes, go ahead.
Yes. I can agree with you on the point that it's what motivates some thieves, in my case, that I've had to run up with, they are motivated by some idea that they're going to profit from it. As a contractor, the cost of metals have gone up tremendously in the last year, and on one of my job sites here in town, we have guys cruising the alleys, on bicycles, cars, trucks, any piece of metal you set outside the building on my property, they think it's theirs. They load it up the next morning, it won't be there. It's gone.
Uh-huh.
And the scrap yards here in town that buy the metal, they must know that, you know, when somebody brings in a brand new roll of wire or something, they'll buy it. But so we got a couple of things going on. We got the thieves taking it, and we got the scrap yards buying it. And if you call the scrap yard on it, they say, well, we can't police everybody. That's not our job. You know, here's a guy going down the street with a brand new wheel. He's stolen aluminum wheel. You can see it carrying on a bicycle. And he's going to take it to the scrap yard. They'll buy that. Brand new wheel. Who's going to bring a brand new wheel over there? Who's going to bring brand new roll of copper wire, brand new pipes over there? But that's what's happened. Anyway, that was my situation. And to me, what's motivated these guys is the price of metal up. Their motivation for being thieves, and that's what's happened here in our town, and we had a big rash of this going on, according to the police, what they tell me.
Yes, apparently it's going on elsewhere, too. We've had a rash of copper thefts from air conditioning units, but in any case, we know the crime persists and changes its face from time to time, in part because of these supporting institutions. Changes in market conditions. I mean, obviously, or I assume it's obvious from what you say, the price of scrap metal has reached a point where it's profitable to steal it now and sell it.
But it's funny how these guys, they seem to think that if you put a piece of metal outside and it's not fenced in, then you have just the right, you don't want that, I'm going to take that. You know, and I saw something on PBS one time where they get a bunch of parents in a room, and they say, "Hey, would your kid steal if he found a wallet? Would he turn it back in and had the address and phone number?" "Oh yes, oh yes." They got all the kids in another room, and they ask the kids, "If you found a wallet that's got $100 bill in there, what would you do?" "Well, I'd take the $100 bill out and then might call the guy back." And the guy says, "Well, I just take the $100 bill out and throw it in the garbage."
As distressed.
That, you know, their kids, did you teach your kids not to steal? If it doesn't belong to them, give it back. They, oh, yeah, we did. We taught them that. But anyway, I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Well, Professor Shover, you can comment on that any way you like.
Well, as distressing as it must be to people who have things stolen that they leave out unattended for any period of time, in the world of white-collar crime, it's not terribly significant problem. I mean, I can understand why that would make one unhappy if you had to change your daily routine and the way you do things for no other reason than to keep people, outlaws, from carrying stuff off. But that's a significant part of the problem of white-collar crime.
Hmm. Well, this, I guess it does go to a very basic question, and that is how do people decide if there's something that they're thinking about doing? How is it they decide whether it's right or wrong to do it? And you know, particularly, say, you're talking about white-collar crime. I mean, how do you get at the state of mind of the individual to find out whether, in fact, they thought they believed they were doing something wrong? Or that in some of these cases, I think a defense has been made that the executives, they didn't think that they were doing anything wrong, and that somehow that goes to the question of whether or not they're guilty, whether or not they actually believe they were committing a crime or not.
Well, probably the one characteristic that distinguishes white-collar criminals from all of their criminal cousins, whatever color collars they might wear. The one thing that distinguishes white-collar criminals is a refusal to use the word criminal and the word crime to refer to them or to their actions, respectively. They simply cannot and will not do this. They have a whole list of words that they used when they talk about the fact that they've committed crime. Mistakes is a common one. Whether or not they were of the same mindset when they committed those acts, which are criminal, who knows? We have nothing to go on except what they tell us, and the pattern, the tracings of the actions they took. If there are files, if there are computer records, these things give us some insight into how, whether people were aware that they were doing something wrong or not. And if one looks at the emails and this sort of thing, in many of these cases, perhaps not many, but at least some of these cases, the very way that they communicated with one another and the way they talked about the act behind the scenes suggests that, yes, they knew it was wrong and they were committing crime. Now, when they're caught, like Jeffrey Skilling, they almost to a person insist that what they did was not serious. It didn't merit all this attention. It was just a politically zealous prosecutor who singled them out, unfairly, I might add, for prosecution. This is a refrain which is heard over and over again. And probably the only type of criminal offenders who are like this in their steadfast refusal to acknowledge that they committed crime and that they are criminals are sexual predators. People who've gone out and stolen lawnmowers or chainsaws or broken into a place, once they pass through the court system, they are the first people in the world to admit that what they did and admit that it's criminal and that laws prohibiting that sort of thing are needed. Almost to a person, sexual offenders deny everything or minimize everything, and in that, white-collar criminals are the same.
Let's talk with someone else who is listening. This is someone in Urbana, and it's line one.
Hi. As a longtime teacher and parent of four children, I think basically what kids say on the playground and what they say in your backyard is about the same thing. No, I didn't do it. And one time, fortunately, my son and a couple of his friends were caught when they were in middle school stealing something. And we were really shocked that he did it. And I said, why did you do that? And I think here is the really crux of it all. He said, because we thought we could get away with it. And I think people think they can take things for their personal gain, and they think they're smart enough to get away with it. I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Well, I agree with you 100%. That's the thesis of the book, that if there's been an increase in white-collar crime, and we believe there's good reason to believe there is an increase, one of the reasons is that oversight has diminished and has not kept pace with the flood of new white-collar criminal opportunities. So theoretically, there's every reason to believe that you are correct. They believe that they can get away with it.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're not thinking about the possibility of getting caught. In either case, they go ahead and do it.
And I think maybe, too, you would also make the argument that that in any crime there is this rational choice. People, it's at some level, before they're doing it, they're thinking, okay, now what happens here? Should I do this? Should I not do this? And part of that thinking there is, well, what happens if I get caught? And if you have the idea that if you get caught, punishment will be certain and severe, well, that might make you less likely to take the chance of committing the crime. But if you don't really think that there will be much in the way of consequences, then...
Or if you think you're not going to get caught.
Or if you think you're not going to get caught, then, you know... So that goes to the question of how it is we think about white-collar crime, how it is we investigate it, and what are the consequences for people who are found guilty. That all of that makes it seem likely that a person is going to think, well, I'm not going to get caught, or possibly they're going to think, well, if I get caught, it's not going to be that big a deal.
Correct. That is the assumption, that one of the assumptions at the heart of the notion that crime is choice, that rational choice theory. I should say that there's reason a priori to assume that white-collar offenders are more rational than street offenders. Start with the fact that on average they're 10 years older than street offenders, so they have the benefit of the wisdom and maturity that comes with 10 years of additional life on this earth. For the most part, they live and they work in worlds where rational, prudent behavior is expected. They're monitored. They're rewarded for behaving rationally. There's reason then to believe that white-collar offenders are capable and should act more rationally than street offenders, who oftentimes they're predominantly young males, and they make decisions to commit crime while they're in the company of other young males, where there's illicit drugs in the mix and a lot of posturing going on, and these are not the circumstances in which people make clear-headed, intelligent decisions. White-collar offenders are different.
Let me again introduce our guest, Neil Shover. He is a sociologist. He teaches at University of Tennessee at Knoxville and teaches courses in criminology, white-collar crime, and criminal justice. He's the author of a number of books having to do with those subjects, with criminology, including the one that I mentioned here that was published last fall, Choosing White-Collar Crime, which he co-authored, and the book is published by the Cambridge University Press. We have some other folks here who want to join in the conversation, so we will do that. Going back here to a caller in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I'm curious. I was wondering if the guest could speak to the fact of white-collar crime as more of a business risk rather than a conscious decision. I mean, it is a conscious decision, but a business risk in aspect of making the crime.
Can you do that, Professor Shover?
If I understand what you're saying correctly, it seems that from the vantage point of those who are at risk of being victimized, crime is definitely a risk which must be taken account, need not be taken account of, but a prudent person would take account of. Approaching crime itself as one form of risky behavior or as one form of risk-taking is an approach which is very much favored by some academics. In the process, crime disappears from usage and it simply becomes risky behavior. Risky behavior is one thing. Crime is something different. They can't lock you up for risky behavior. They can lock you up for criminal behavior. I think there's there are good reasons from a policymaking standpoint and from a morality standpoint that we not lose the distinctiveness of crime by folding it into categories that are vacuous or lack this moral dimension.
Well, I guess I'm just saying about businesses choosing to commit a crime, saying if they get away with it, the benefits would probably be better off in the long run. And even if they do get caught, it might only be a couple $1 million fine, whereas if they got away with it, they could make hundreds of millions of dollars.
I gather perhaps what you mean risk in the same way that I'm talking about weighing or assessing the potential outcomes of risking crime or of committing crime. Yeah, to the extent that you're trying to to the extent that you choose to commit crime and you make some kind of estimate of what the odds are that it will be detected, and if detected, something unpleasant will happen, then that's a risk assessment, I assume. And so perhaps we're talking about the same thing, but just using slightly different words. I don't know.
Well, that's fine. I appreciate you fielding the question.
Thank you.
All right, well, thanks for the call. Let's go next to someone here on line number two, and this person is in Champaign. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Hello.
When you talked about oversight, I imagine there's two kinds of oversight that I can think of. One is government, state, federal, county, whatever, oversight. And the other is just oversight by the top echelon of the company.
Uh-huh.
Well, in Enron, of course, it was happening right there. But could you discuss what you mean by oversight? And I'll hang up and listen.
Well, oversight can take several forms. There's self-restraint to the extent that one feels bound by some notion of conscience, and the distinction between right and wrong. That's one form of oversight. And you're correct, there is a form of oversight provided by your superiors or even your working mates in an organization. And of course, there's formal or state oversight. But there's a variety of kinds of oversight, and I've only mentioned two or three of them. Increasingly, the movement in oversight of white-collar occupations and organizations is towards putting more emphasis on self-restraint and self-monitoring and oversight from within, so that the state steps back and has put the responsibility on organizations to monitor themselves and to provide summary measures to the state that they are doing that properly, that they've taken that responsibility seriously, and that when misconduct has occurred, that they have taken appropriate action. So oversight takes different forms, and it's changing rapidly right now.
Hmm. All right. Again, I hope that gets to the question of the caller. We'll talk next with someone in Charleston on our line 4. Hello.
Yes, I want to address an issue, and hopefully your guest can tie it in with his expertise and this book about white-collar crime. Well, I want to describe here in Coles County three entities that are going to be foisted up on the people of this county, and which affects everyone. We are the so-called FutureGen electric plant, a coal burner, that pipes the pipes, I put emphasis on that word, pipes the unwanted material into the ground underneath a sandstone plate. Then we have right here in Charleston a proposed ethanol plant, and up in Oakland, another coal gasification. All these things are horribly polluting. The people have been given all these reasons why we need this based on the comments of George Bush, who said we have to become energy independent, which we cannot under the present paradigm. There's absolutely no way that housing, population, automobiles, other sorts of human activity based on the use of energy, that we can ever keep up with it. And the comment by, not a comment, but an ad right on Channel 12 I heard this morning on the first hour of the program about protecting the Muhammad Aquifer. Here in Charleston, we have only a sand aquifer, and it takes, and it'll be 6-to-1 ethanol, 12 gallons of wastewater from the ethanol, and it still cannot help the fuel situation. My father-in-law, who is a farmer, my brother-in-law is a farmer, says there are only 2 years supply before the demand cannot keep up, or the supply cannot keep up with the demand. Now, if this, what I'm trying to drive at, is not taking it far away from your guest, is that these things are going to be foisted upon the people who have only agenda is money. That it will bring into the treasury, and the local city councils that number between 5 and 7 people will vote on this in or out. And meanwhile, the public is left standing out here without any input and having all these egregious corporate and crimes against the people wherever they're at, whether it's here or worldwide. Can your guest talk about those? You know, am I off the mark?
As I listened to you, I was kept trying to think of how can I tie this into white-collar crime, because they appear on the surface, at least, to be in very different fields, agriculturally even. But the more I thought about your comments, it seems to me that those activities, or what's taking place there in central Illinois, and what we write about in the area of white-collar crime and white-collar crime that we see taking place, that it's differences in power, inequality in power, which explains many important aspects about white-collar crime, and I assume explains some of the unfortunate dynamics of what's taking place there near where you live. And power inequity in power cannot be separated from the study of white-collar crime, nor can it be separated from the political realm.
All right. Well, I guess I want to thank the caller, and hope you wouldn't mind if I go and get to some others. We'll go to Urbana next. This is line number 3. Hello.
Hi. It seems to me that all kinds of crime has to do a lot with how much we see ourselves as responsible to our community, as opposed to whether or not we're going to get caught. And I think religion plays a role in this, in terms of something I felt since a child when I had friends who would they would list the costs of this misdemeanor versus that demeanor in their religion. And I always thought to myself, why are you doing this? Why don't you just do the right thing in the first place instead of doing the wrong thing and then asking for forgiveness? And it just really bugs me that we seem to have this idea that we can, that our actions don't have an effect on the larger community and making the world worse or better. It's just a matter of whether we're going to get caught, and if we're going to get caught, whether we're going to get forgiven or not. That's my big global thought for the morning. Any thoughts about that?
I don't disagree with any of that. There's good research evidence that the moral among us are people who never consider doing things right or never reach a point where they are weighing the likely odds of getting caught. That kind of calculus only comes into play on the part of people who are already released from any sense of conscience or moral obligation. And I think there's reason to believe people have argued, certainly David Callahan in the book The Cheating Culture has argued, that we have seen in the past three decades in America the development of a culture of cheating, because we have become more intensely competitive than at any time in our history, and that this fuels or feeds this willingness to overlook transgression and breaking rules because winning has become so important. I don't disagree with you at all.
You know, this it gets at something, this question of, I suppose, moral character and who has it and who doesn't and where you get it and whether that should be part of education. I want to raise, and I want to be careful about making too sweeping a conclusion based on just one study, but I do want to raise the results of one particular study. This was reported fairly recently, I guess. This was a study that was done of graduate students in the U.S. and Canada, 5,300 of them. And it was done by a professor at Rutgers, Donald McCabe, who teaches in the business school, apparently there at Rutgers, who found that they took a look at graduate students by what it was that they study and asked them how likely they were to cheat or whether, in fact, they had cheated. And the graduate business students said apparently they were the most likely to cheat on their work than people in other fields. 56% of them said they admitted to having cheated in the past year, and many of them said they cheated because they believed it was an accepted practice in business. Following the business students, 54% of the graduate engineering students said they had cheated, 50% of the physical science students, 49% of the med and healthcare students, 45% of law students, 43% of liberal arts students, and 39% of social science and humanities students. Now, I don't mean to suggest that people in the social sciences are more moral or have better character, but this does raise some question about who goes into business as a field, and does that mean that people in business schools ought to be thinking about making sure that they build some ethics education into their programs?
Well, that's one implication that perhaps they need to spend more time teaching and talking about ethics. One of the difficulties with that approach, and I don't mean in any way to diminish the potential effectiveness of having more emphasis on ethics education, but one of the shortcomings of that approach is it ignores the fact that when people get out into the work world, they're in a work group or they work in an organization, and because they're in a social context, that what happens in that context and the messages they receive override or cause them to pay less attention to these ethical standards which they were taught in graduate school or at their mother's knee, I don't know. And so it's the culture of business schools. It's the culture of business that's partly responsible for the fact that even ethical people do unethical things on the job.
Well, I guess it, again, it sort of goes back to, I don't mean to, you know, belabor this point, but I suppose it does go back to this very, very fundamental question about why it is that people behave themselves. Do they behave themselves and do what's right and not break the law because they think that's the right thing to do, or they do that because they think, if I do break the law, I'm going to get caught. I'm going to be punished. I don't want that. So, you know, which is it? Is it because it's the right thing or because they fear the consequences if they do the wrong thing?
Well, in the best of all worlds, people would behave because they've internalized some sort of standards of behavior and would reproach themselves if they transgressed or broke a rule or did something improper. At the same time, they might weigh the potential consequences if their parents found out or if their closest friends found out, and the disappointment that these significant others in their lives would feel if they became aware of this. These are, and of course, there's this threat from the law and what the state can do to you. The ideal, I suppose, is to raise people in a world where it's possible for them to internalize fairly clear-cut and unambiguous moral standards which can be applied unequivocally or unambiguously in a whole range of circumstances. The world is so complex that that's difficult to do. And I mean, we're surrounded by, we live in a competitive culture where the fires of consumption are stoked ceaselessly, and it's not as simple as just inculcating a few simple moral standards in the home and then sending people out into a world where that sort of thing is respected, repeated, reinforced, because that's not what happens in the world.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take some other calls. Champagne is next, line one. Hello.
Yeah, let's see. I guess a few points and let you comment them. We really don't have a government that serves as a very good model in terms of, certainly in the environment, some of the cheating that goes on, and also, in other words, cheating around the edges, you don't quite, you know, it can... You know, it's in terms of the law, maybe not exactly, well, anyway, maybe I'm making it. But also, in terms of the environment, in terms of deregulation that we're in, I wonder in terms of this is actually for white-collar crimes, has had some. And then also, finally, the severity, I mean, the people in terms of blue-collar crime or whatever that is, that the severity seems to be very out of proportion. And what happens in white-collar crime, they really traditionally got off very easily. So I'll let you comment on any or in of those, okay?
Okay. Well, again, Professor Shover, go ahead.
Well, I'm happy that you mentioned this deregulatory movement, which we've been living with for at least 20 years now, and it's important because if one tries to understand white-collar crime theoretically and whether it's increasing or decreasing, then one reason to assume that it might be increasing is because we've seen a pullback in state oversight. We've seen this deregulatory movement, and that gives every reason to believe that a higher proportion of business firms and individuals would be taking risk and breaking the law. There's no question but what there's a great discrepancy between the severity with which we respond to street crime and the way we respond to white-collar crime. Now, it's true that there's been some upturn in the severity of penalties for white-collar crime in the past 15 years since the U.S. Sentencing Commission was created and produced its handiwork. But it's not an impressive increase. And more important, those penalties fall on a minuscule proportion of those who commit white-collar crime. So on the one hand, there's some evidence that at least on the criminal side of enforcement, they've tried to toughen up, but those penalties fall on just a handful of offenders. And on the other hand, there's been this deregulatory movement, and if you add these things together, it probably amounts to a reduction in oversight. And when the cat's away, the mice will play.
Okay, let's talk next with someone in Clinton, Illinois, line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hello, yes. This ties into it.
I can just barely hear.
Okay, I'm sorry. Is that better?
Yes, that is better.
Okay, yeah, thanks.
This ties into a pet theory I've had, and I don't know how far back it goes, but let's say, and maybe you could firm up a date on when the 401k program was established and when mutual funds started to become very, very popular, but I don't think it's been more than 25 years ago. Back then, you know, a person would buy a stock, an individual stock, and yes, they were concerned about the performance of that stock and the profit of the company, but they would have never voted in a board whose cuts were so draconian that they created a profit that basically would result in the end of the company itself. You know, now you have a system where people purchase something out of a 401k, and it's a mutual fund that's tech stocks or the S&P 500. And most people have no idea what the individual makeup of that stock plan is. And, of course, they have no voting rights on individual stocks in that plan. They just have voting rights, you know, as toward the what the overall overseer of the 401k plan wants to do. Has that got us in a situation where all that matters is, you know, the devil, if the company goes out of business, you know, it's all just about pure bottom line, and I hope you understand what I'm getting at here. Am I making any sense?
I do and I don't.
Well, before, when a person would buy an individual stock, for instance, yes, obviously they wanted to make a profit, but they would have never voted in a board who basically would have suggested eliminating the company as a means of achieving profit. And we seem to have lost that level, goes away entirely when you've got a bunch of people who are just putting money in 401ks, and you know all they do is look at the return on the plan and then move on if they don't like it.
Well, it's an example of what I was talking about a few minutes ago, where it's one thing to teach ethics to business students, but when they go out into the world, they find themselves in a network or a maze, perhaps, of economic relationships, which make it easier or justify or excuse breaking the law. But having said that, there we do know that some companies behave ethically, and some companies rarely commit crime or are rarely caught committing crime. Other companies we know play fast and loose, and we know that because they're getting caught and because of other scandals that take place. So, I mean, you put your finger on an important issue, which is the issue of separation of ownership and control of wealth. But the fact is, there are reputable and responsible corporations, and so the hope is that something can be learned from those that behave responsibly that can be applied to those that don't behave responsibly.
You know, we're coming to the point here, I'm sorry to say, that we're going to have to finish, because we've simply used our time, and there are some folks that we won't be able to take. Just to bring us around sort of to the point where we started, it sounds as if, if you're concerned about white-collar crime, you're trying to answer the question of why does it exist? Do we have more of it? What to do about it? You might say, in connecting it to the comments of the last caller, that there may be more temptations than there have been. Perhaps there are more avenues for people to profit than there have been in the past. And that it is a matter, like all crime, it is a matter of rational choice. That is, the person is sitting there thinking, okay, if I do this, what happens? What do I gain? What do I lose? What are the chances of getting caught? What happens if I get caught? If we're concerned about white-collar crime, then what we have to do is to make sure that when their people are sitting down sizing things up, making their choices, is that they have to really be considering the likelihood that they're going to get caught. That is, we have to put our efforts into enforcement. We have to make sure that there are stiff penalties, and we have to make sure that people think that there's a good chance that they're going to get caught. We don't want them to think that they're going to get away with it, because if they think they can get away with it, then we know that there are people who will take the chance.
That's correct.
I've given you nothing to say now, but I guess that essentially that's what we're saying.
That's correct.
Well, at that, I guess we will leave it with our thanks. By the way, if you're interested in reading some of the work that our guest has done on the subject, you can look for one of his books, this book that he has co-authored. It's titled Choosing White Collar Crime. It's published by the Cambridge University Press. Our guest is Neil Shover. He is a professor
University of Tennessee.
Yes, thank you. I'm glad you know. I'm having to look at my schedule. He's a professor of sociology at the University of Tennessee at Knoxville, where he teaches courses in criminology, white-collar crime, and criminal justice. And Professor Shover, thanks very much for talking.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We certainly appreciate it.